Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Katie Hannan. Let me right away introduce my panel. We have Colm Brophy, Minister of State with responsibility for Overseas Development Aid and Diaspora, Breed Smith, People Before Profit TD and Member of the Dáil Committee on the COVID Crisis, David Cullinan, Sinn Féin Spokesperson on Health, Dr Aina Kelly, Chair of the Public Health Committee of the IMO and Consultant in Public Health Medicine, Mary Culleton, past president of the Academy of Clinical Science and Laboratory Medicine and laboratory manager at the National Maternity Hospital, and Duncan Graham, CEO of Retail Excellence. Now, we want to hear from you. Think, should those who gave evidence to the Mother and Baby Homes Commission have access to their personal information? Should we just accept rolling lockdowns until a vaccine is available? And is it fair to fine people for not wearing a mask or travelling outside the 5 kilometre limit? Text us on 51551, email saturday at rte.ie. Or tweet to at Saturday RTE. Now, there were glimmers of light today. We should acknowledge them and hang on to them when we see them. That front page lead in The Independent that we could see the first consignment of a COVID-19 vaccine from Pfizer by the end of the year. And there's early signs that restrictions may be having an impact on the spread of the virus, with that sharp drop in the average number of close contacts. They've gone from an average of 6 at the start of the month to an average of 3 now. And the positivity rate falling as well from almost 9% 7 days ago to just under 6% now. But it's not all good news on this front this morning. A very worrying report in the Irish Examiner about an outbreak in Naas General Hospital, where at least 18 staff and 9 patients have so far tested positive. And that was after a patient transferred from a Dublin hospital without being tested. And there are more questions to answer about the handling of the recall of the ViroPro hand sanitizer. And we might start with that story, Minister Colm Brophy. We now know that suspect batches of this hand sanitizer, this defective hand sanitizer, were being tested as far back as September. We know the Department of Agriculture knew this hand sanitizer was defective on October 16th. That's Friday of last week. We know there was communication between the Departments of Agriculture and Education about this last Tuesday. So why was the Agriculture Minister, Charlie McConnellogue, according to his own account, not informed about this until Thursday?
Well, I mean, the minister should have been informed earlier about it. As far as I know, by the way, the timeline starts on the 8th of October in relation to when people became aware from a report that was given in relation to consignments coming in from, I believe, Turkey. As you say correctly, the testing was done around the 16th of October. On the 20th of October, there was a removal of the product from the register. But as the minister has acknowledged himself, there should have been a much earlier consideration of A, informing him and the department moving to make it aware, to make the public aware. I know tradition.
With respect, we all know that. I mean, yeah. I think anyone would acknowledge that. But why? Why? Know, have we any idea why this didn't happen?
I can't give you an answer to that, because the genuine answer is obviously I'm as aware as you are of the statement issued last night by the minister. I know no doubt the minister will be enlarging on that in terms of it. My understanding to date is that normally what would happen is the department would issue a notice to a company to withdraw a product and the company would move to withdraw the product. This didn't happen. It certainly didn't happen at the speed required. And it was at that case that the department officials then both notified the minister, and that the minister and the department immediately took the decision to, on Thursday the 22nd, to issue the withdrawal from school.
Are you shocked, though, Minister, that sequence of events, and that the minister was kept in the dark over such a serious matter, given that the HSE had spent millions on this product? We're told 9.2 million spent on this defective product in February and April by the HSE, given that we knew that schools had been told to use this product and many schools had this product and were putting it on the children's hands.
I think that, as the minister has said himself, it would have been better if this had been dealt with in a more speedier way. And I think it would have been better if the officials within the department had informed the minister. Unfortunately, we have to deal with the fact that that didn't happen. And I know that the minister has now put in place systems to ensure that that's something like that will not happen again, and that it will be dealt with in a speedier way in the future. And yes, it is unfortunate that it wasn't dealt with faster and quicker within the officials in the department making the minister aware of it. I think everybody would have preferred that. I would make the point, though, always within these type of situations, that you're dealing with a whole system operating with the background of a pandemic where millions, as you say quite correctly, of pounds and euros are being spent every day on various aspects of PPE, on various aspects of equipment.
Oh, you can't blame the pandemic now on this basic breakdown in communication between a minister and his officials.
I'm just making the point that there is so much that is happening at such a speed that people are doing their best. I don't believe that people don't go in to do their job in the morning and not attempt to do their best. But there was a breakdown, and I think it would have been better if that had been communicated to the minister faster.
Before I let Breed in, can I just move on to the other minister in this then, the Minister for Education and the Department of Education? Because we now know that even though we were told at some stage yesterday that they didn't find out all about this until Thursday or all the details until Thursday, we now know they did know that the name and the product that was defective from Tuesday. And yet, principals were only alerted really late on Thursday night in circumstance where many of them were unable to open up their schools the next day. And again, very unfortunate, the day it was, it's one of the most exciting days in the year for young kids who've had a very tough year. And I mean, is that's surely unacceptable.
Well, I think it was, as you say, a really important day for a lot of school kids and who were really looking forward to going into school to have that Halloween celebration, which is something we wanted them to have in school, just to re-emphasise again for a second, because we want people to behave safely over Halloween itself and not do the traditional trick-or-treating on a door-to-door basis. So yes, that was disappointing for the limited number of schools that actually then had to move to close as a result of it. But obviously there was, and the Minister has acknowledged this, the Minister for Agriculture has acknowledged this, it would have been better if that communication had come quicker so as the things could have been put in place.
But am I right in saying the communication did happen on Tuesday? Well, I think the Department of Education didn't move to inform principals until Thursday night.
I think what the Department of Education did was it moved as fast as it could to inform the schools on it.
How was Tuesday to Thursday night as fast as they could?
Well, my understanding is as soon as the minister was aware and had the information, they moved to make that statement on Thursday night.
That's not what the department have confirmed.
The department have confirmed they were aware on Tuesday, and then there was when everything was worked through, there was a statement issued on Thursday. That's, I can't clarify more than that.
Breed.
Well, at the start, Colm did say, unless I heard him incorrectly, that when a defective product like this is found to be defective and needs to be withdrawn, that the company are told and they're asked to withdraw it. And that in itself seems to me like an extraordinary system. In an issue like this, where the sanitizers in schools, in health centres, in hospitals, in public spaces, that it was left up to the company to withdraw it for a number of days. When they didn't do it, then the department acted. Why should it be left up to a company who, exported defective hand sanitizer in the first place to then withdraw? That's a public health issue, and that should have been dealt with by the department immediately, not leaving it up to the private company to do it. So I find that extraordinary. And no matter what sort of excuses you make, there's systemic failure here. And a lot of teachers, principals were extremely stressed out about it. And it has caused, as you said, rightly said, a lot of disappointment to children. But more importantly, we don't know if within those extra 2 days that people were using this, that there wasn't harm done to them. You know, that at that time they didn't get harm done to them, either respiratory harm or harm to their skin. So it's just not good enough.
OK, can I, David Cullinan?
Yes, well, I think the first and obvious point to make is that we all know that hand washing and hand hygiene is a very important tool that we have at our disposal to prevent the spread of the virus. And this this equipment was in not just schools, but it was also in nursing homes. It was widely used. It was available for general purchase. And I am concerned about the timelines and how quickly we responded here, because my understanding is on the 26th of September, the Department of Agriculture were first informed by Revenue, and Revenue in turn were informed by the EU Anti-Fraud Unit, OLAF. It wasn't until the 16th of October that they confirmed or realised that the product was dangerous. It took 4 more days before action was taken. And that was taken on the Tuesday. And we are led to believe that the Minister for Agriculture was informed only on the Thursday, 2 days after that. And we don't know when the Minister for Education was informed. So it is quite extraordinary that a product that people were using to prevent the spread of the virus, at a time when we are in the middle of a second surge, for goodness sake, that the ministers weren't informed. And it would seem that officials in departments were responding, but ministers were not responding, because if they are to believe, they weren't even aware of it. And that to me is absolutely unacceptable and speaks to the chaos that we have here at this point in time. And there are so many different issues at the moment, it's hard to keep up with all of it. But in relation to this, I think that the ministers should have been informed, and I think that there should have been much, much swifter action. Because how is it that the state was informed on the 26th of September, but it wasn't until much, much later that action was actually taken to recall these products? And I feel that what should have happened on the 26th of September, given that hand hygiene is so central to preventing the spread of the virus, that the state should have suspended use of this product pending a full review. That's what should have happened. It didn't happen.
Yeah, and just before I put that back to the minister here, I want to bring in Duncan Graham. Duncan, some of your retail excellence members would have been selling this product and presumably using it perhaps for customers coming into their outlets. Are you surprised at how this was handled?
Yeah, very surprised. I mean, we're talking about over a week, aren't we, between when it was first announced and the fact that we're now talking about it being withdrawn now?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're just listening to that timeline that David Cullinan was outlining there, Revenue did tell the department back at the end of September, September 26th, that there were issues with this. So it goes back even further than that.
Yeah, so it's staggering. I mean, retailers are very used to product recalls and things like that. But, you know, to have this out there in the schools and in retail outlets for this length of time is frankly staggering. It's unbelievable that we've got to this point.
Minister, staggering and unbelievable.
Well, as the Minister has said himself, the Minister for Agriculture has said himself, there will be a review to determine what happened, and there will be a review to look at what needs to be changed. It is, I would agree, as I said in my initial remarks, it is very disappointing, I think, that this wasn't brought through to the Minister much, much quicker. Unlike David, who, you know, will say things are always a calamity or whatever, I think that officials within the department were working, I have no doubt, in good faith to try and bring a resolution. But there is a problem that it wasn't resolved fast enough, and it wasn't brought to the minister's attention fast enough, which I think once it was, he took the correct actions in terms of making the decisions. But from that initial point where the initial the consignment in question, which was asked to be tested, the test results came back on that on the 8th of October. And that time lag between then and effectively yesterday is too long.
Okay, we'll move on from there, because public health doctors say they will ballot for strike action if a deal with the government on consultant contracts is not agreed by November 30th. I'm joined now by Dr. Aine Kelly, Chair of the Public Health Committee of the IMO and Consultant in Public Health Medicine. You're very welcome, Dr. Kelly.
It's been
well documented that you and your colleagues on public health teams around the country are overstretched and have been overstretched trying to battle this pandemic. And a lot of controversy this week about the overload and temporary suspension of the contact tracing system last weekend. Can you tell me, and I know you're two separate ends of this, but how did that affect you and your colleagues?
Well, Katie, the contact tracing system was developed in order to support the departments of public health in our investigation and control work, which is what we normally do. And obviously early on in the pandemic, when the numbers rose in wave one, they were developed to help us with this and to support us in dealing with a lot of the high volume, low complexity work. And of course, the procedures we have for them to help us involve they call people first and they inform them first and they give us information on cases so that we can do our complex work in relation to investigation and control of maybe outbreaks particularly. And when there's a delay then in that part of the system, it delays everything else as well. Now, we try to pull casework from the system ourselves on an ongoing basis anyway. But of course, when the numbers have gone up so much as well, our workload was very high in lots of other ways as well in relation to your outbreaks across the system. And so the delays in the contact tracing had knock-on delays for ourselves. So it increased our workload and it hampered our investigation and control work as well. And look, it's unfortunate, I suppose, in a way, that's the problem about COVID-19 is that it's such a transmissible virus and it multiplies in an exponential fashion. Therefore, the numbers go up very quickly when control is diminishing, and that's what's happened in this case. So I suppose when we're already under strength services starting out, it's a huge challenge then when the numbers go up.
And can you tell me, where are you most worried about now? What kind of settings are you seeing these outbreaks occurring in most now?
Well, I suppose our biggest worry is our most vulnerable groups, and they are the older people and people with the underlying health conditions. And so therefore, people in nursing homes, you know, residential care facilities and disability units and so on are areas where we really, really want to protect those people so much.
And are we seeing concerning levels of outbreaks in these places now?
Well, the numbers of outbreaks have gone up, and I suppose it's not unexpected, because when the numbers of cases in the community rise, then the risk then of bringing it into a nursing home or any other facility like that, it arises. I mean, it's both in terms of, healthcare workers live in communities, so they can bring it in, and they may not even know it if they're asymptomatic. And of course, people who live in nursing homes do go to hospital, come back from hospital, they transfer to other nursing homes sometimes to be near other family members and so on. So movement then is a potential of bringing it into a nursing home as well.
And but are we not testing everybody before they're moved in and out now?
There are protocols, and the protocols work very, very well. And I mean, I suppose it's something that isn't really picked up on a lot is prevention. There are so many preventive activities that are occurring, and they are, there's a huge amount of volume of high quality preventive work happening. Naturally, you would have an awful lot more clusters and outbreaks if that preventive work wasn't happening, you know.
And in that line, can I just ask you, I'll get on to your issues with the negotiations, IR negotiations at the moment. I just want to very, very quickly ask you about the school support teams, because I know we are hearing about more outbreaks in schools now, and we all know, of course, that the primary principals are complaining that they've, had to wait for guidance from public health authorities. Are we on top of that now, and what extra supports will we be able to put in place for them over this break?
Well, I suppose there are a few things here. One of the things is that there's a variable level of strength in public health. Say, if you're talking about public health support to schools, some departments of public health in Ireland are not just under strength, but they're very few. There's almost no specialists in those departments at all. And so I can't speak about every part of Ireland. I work in the Department of Public Health in the Midlands, and I do know we provide a fairly responsive service, and we're able to support schools very well. But it is a challenge for the schools, because this is not something that they have experienced before. And first of all, hopefully very good guidelines have been developed for the schools. That's the feedback we're getting. And therefore, they have put in an awful lot of preventive measures. But for all that, they're going to have children who attend school, or maybe teachers or other staff who have been infected in the community and will come into the school, and therefore the school is going to have to respond to that. Most of the cases that come into the school are sole cases, and they stay that way. We've tested an awful lot, I can say, now in the last few weeks, and have found very little spread between children and schools. And that fits in with the data from other countries who've been looking at this before. But obviously, we also have in schools, we have teachers and other staff who are of a different age group and more at risk and more likely to, the infectiousness is probably higher in that in older age groups once we get to adulthood. And so schools have a lot of, there's a lot to be concerned about insofar as trying to protect everybody and trying to provide the education service that is such an important part of our society.
Okay. Well, can I ask you then about this issue that you have in relation to the status of public health doctors and consultant contracts? We know this has been rumbling along for decades, really. So is there a sense that you're nearing resolution on this now?
Well, we were supposed to have resolved it in July 2020. This is earlier on this year. And, there was a Crowhorwith review about higher specialist training and so on. And Scally both recommended that we get consultant status. And I don't know if you know, but we are consultant level doctors who are trained, same as all other branches of medicine in the College of Physicians, for instance, who are consultant level, and we have we're all on specialist register of the Medical Council, but we don't have consultant level employment, and we are not even employed to carry out specialist serious high level specialist work, but we do that. And it's been going on for decades, as you say. But in the last few years, with the Scalia report and the Crowhorwith report, we started negotiating with the department, but it stopped early in the year. The pandemic held it back, but also the elections and the disruption to the political system. And so in reality, instead of actually fixing it this year, it's actually been delayed and delayed at a time when public health medicine is critical to the country, the economy of the country, the health of the country, the you know, and I suppose the health and well-being of everybody. And it's a critical part of getting clinical leadership into managing COVID. We need to be allowed to work at the top of our license. Prevention is the best value for money. It's not very exciting, because if it doesn't happen, of course, it's invisible. But that's actually what we all need, is very good prevention to look after us and protect us.
Can I just ask you, just there's a major recruitment drive, we were told, to beef up public health teams around the country. Like, is that is that, how is that going? And can that work when you have this issue about status and pay?
I suppose there are two things. One of the things that's meant to happen is reform of the public health medical system, in which we would build up our multidisciplinary teams. And there is some recruitment started, but it's very slow, and it's not going to bring in many more clinicians. It's going to bring in maybe support staff, which would be very welcome, but not necessarily sufficient. And unfortunately, because of the delays in dealing with the consultant contract part, we are, retention and recruitment is going to become an urgent issue very soon. You know, we have the inequality and the disrespect that has been, that we have all been bearing for so long, has become unsustainable, really. And people just can't bear it anymore. They're very frustrated.
What do you mean about disrespect?
I suppose when you're, I suppose we're, you know, we're predominantly women in public health medicine, and we are, when you're not treated equally, that is disrespectful. You're not listened to in the same way, because you're not being paid the same as your colleagues who have equal training, but have a different contract, a better contract, a more appropriate contract. And we've been very tolerant for a very long time and have put up with it. We've been very dedicated, highly trained, you know, we work in the public interest. But there's a certain point in which people can no longer bear the treatment that they've been wielded over many years.
And of course, as you say, this has been an ongoing issue. But like, from talking to some of your colleagues over the last couple of weeks, the pressure that you're all under right now is an added issue, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we've been working so hard since, actually, you started almost in January. I mean, at 31st of December, when I saw the first WHO report, I thought, oh gosh, I hope we get this under control quickly. And of course, it didn't happen. But anyway, then February, we were up all night because we had to ration the tests because there were so few at that particular time. And ever since, we've been working. We went from a 5-day, you know, 8-hour service to a 7-day, probably 12-hour service most of the time. I suppose in the summer, we, lucky enough, got a few, most people got a little bit of a break, but it's been extremely difficult and very challenging. Most people are working much harder and much higher level than they've ever had to work before. We have huge responsibilities to protect the hospitals, to protect the ICUs. I mean, if we can prevent cases, then we can keep the, we can manage, you know, at low level illness, or you know, very low level illness, we can manage it in Ireland. But public health is the front line of the healthcare system to actually protect everybody.
And can I just ask you then, this ballot that that you're going to carry out for strike action, how serious is that? Like, what is the feeling among your IMO members, a public health specialist, in relation to this?
Yeah, we met. We had a virtual meeting some weeks ago, and it was unanimous, concern about the lack of progress, and about the fact that we need to make, this has to happen now, because I suppose when you're
I don't want to cut across, but I just want to get a sense of how serious would this is this threat of how serious should we take this threat of strike action?
I suppose strike action is something that we're hoping is not going to happen at all. We hope it shouldn't come to industrial action, but that does depend on the Department of Health. I mean, we're hoping that the Department of Health can see that this is the most, it's essential we do this. You know, I don't know if people know that in Scotland, for instance, they have 3 times as many consultants, and they're actually on consultant contracts, and say in New Zealand, and we're struggling here with very small numbers and treated with unequal, inferior contracts. And you know, I think that it's so people are Industrial action is one thing, but the other thing, of course, is retention and recruitment. I think that people may also leave. They're being headhunted in the UK. We have people who have been on an ongoing basis who've been asked to go into other jobs. And most of us are dual trained.
So and people could leave, as you say.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so we could have another crisis.
But not only that,
hands.
Though, I think that there's a... not only could they, people are thinking about it now. They're actually looking into their options. And many people have more than one option of very attractive options in comparison to, you know, this system. Yeah, you know, unfortunately,
Okay, and let me put that to the minister here. We know that there was always going to be issues recruiting into this area. We have huge issues even for all right across the health service, but in particular in this area. We know we desperately need more people on these teams. Why are we dragging our feet on sorting out these contracts?
Well, the first thing to say is that the minister has made it very clear that he is in favour of awarding consultant status. And I know that the Minister for Health is working towards that. I obviously accept completely that the crucial role which Dr. Kelly and all her colleagues play is absolutely recognised, and the level of work that has been put in is recognised as well. Obviously, there are a whole series of processes, the exact minutiae and detail of them, I would imagine that Dr. Kelly is better informed than me of, but they have delayed and held up. But I think the key thing is that we wouldn't want to see in any way, I don't think anybody wants to see this ending up in industrial action of any description, because the intent is very clear from government to make the contracts and awards and to create the consultant posts. And I believe with a bit of goodwill that this should be resolvable in the coming months.
Is there trust there, Dr. Kelly?
I suppose we've had trust up until recently, and we were very disappointed that it seemed to have gone backwards. I mean, we recognise, we're a very tolerant bunch, and we did recognise that the pandemic and the election issues slowed down government this year, you know, in moving to something that required, I think, some amendments to FMP legislation and so on. But trust, I suppose, is something that has to be built and maintained. And we feel we've gone backwards, and we're very shocked by that, because the way we feel is that if you can't give an equal contract to a public health consultant level doctor during a pandemic, will it ever happen? So that's where trust is a huge issue at the moment, I think, unfortunately, you know.
Well, I would just say to Dr. Kelly, I hope the trust can be restored in this. You're quite right in your analysis that there was a slow up on the FMP legislation side of things. My understanding is the intention is to get that resolved literally in the coming months, in other words, before the end of the year, and that outstanding issues can be. So I think there is, I just would reiterate, I think there is the goodwill there on both sides to resolve this very quickly.
Breed.
Well, you can obviously hear from Dr. Kelly how frustrated the public health doctors are with this process. And if she says the trust is broken down and they don't detect a very clear intent on the part of government to deal with this, then she's obviously being very sincere in that. These are a very crucial part of our health service. We absolutely need them to be respected and to be treated with equality. And it's interesting, as she points out, that most of them are women. And we could please move to dealing with this. I heard Dr. Houlihan on the late last night saying the government has done its bit. Well, I don't accept that statement, and I don't accept it in this case and in many other cases. But here is just another example of that. So they really do have to resolve it.
David Cullinan.
Yeah, well, obviously public health is now very much on the front line, and I want to take this opportunity, Katie, to praise all of those public health specialists, but also everybody involved in the public health side of it, including all of those involved in testing and tracing. But all of these pay issues are on the agenda now for decades. They go back in some cases as far as 2002. And when the minister talks about a whole series of processes, what is lacking is the political will to deal with this. We're bringing forward emergency legislation all of the time to resolve issues. We know that we have to recruit more staff. We know that there is pay issues and outstanding pay claims for medical lab scientists, as well as the issues for the public health specialists to have parity with hospital consultants. I've engaged with those representative groups, including the Irish Hospital Consultants Association. They don't have the confidence, but they want the minister to act and not just say that there will be promises and progress and then they don't hear anything. We need to see very quickly from the minister the legislation that needs to be brought forward to deal with these issues, and then give give us a fighting chance to recruit the staff that we need in testing and tracing, because we all know that test and trace has to be robust, has to be acceptable in terms of having the capacity. And it is probably the most important tool that we have at our disposal to wrestle back control of the virus on the one hand, but also to stay ahead of it as we come out of this lockdown. And I very much hope that we don't waste the next number of weeks, as the government wasted the summer months, to ratchet up capacity in this area. But to recruit the staff, you have to deal with those issues. And the government have had decades, successive governments, to deal with them, and they haven't done it.
OK, I just want to bring in, you mentioned the testing side of things there. And of course, we know one of the country's main labs, the National Virus Reference Laboratory, used to process the coronavirus tests, will be unable to operate over the next 2 weekends due to unavoidable staff shortages. They process about 600 swabs a day. We're told that these swabs will now be completed by other HSE contracted labs, and this won't impact on national capacity. But we want to see what is the situation as regards capacity out there in the labs. Marie Culleton, or Mary Culleton, I should say, past president of the Academy of Clinical Science and Laboratory Medicine and laboratory manager at the National Maternity Hospital, joins me now. Mary, are you working in your lab? Are you working at full capacity in the labs out there now?
We are certainly ramping up our capacity, Katie. I think it's fair to note that last June and July, the laboratories were managing to produce results at about 8,000 per day. And since that time, we're now up at multiples of that. So in the last reports we have this week, where some days where we had 19,000 tests produced. Over the summer months, we looked at capacity in laboratories, both for equipment and for staffing. The equipment was rather easier to manage, so the HSE, their procurement group, along with the National Pathology Network, has identified the equipment required for each of the 46 testing laboratories and has put a process in place to get those in. And so indeed, in my own laboratory, our equipment was delivered last week, and we're now in the process of verifying that it works for us. As part of that, they also identified that to do the testing, we need staff. And they've identified that there are 64 additional posts needed in our clinical laboratories to provide the testing at the level that we need to, which is over 100,000 tests per week. Unfortunately, those staff are just not out there. And a lot of what Dr. Anna Kelly was saying resonated very well with me and the profession of medical scientists. At the moment, we have recruitment issues, we have retention issues, and some of those recruitment and retention issues are related to the parity of esteem and pay of the medical scientists in comparison with other scientists in the clinical laboratories, and also with their career pathway. We too feel we should be able to work to the limit of our licence. It's a situation now where we need to bring into the laboratories, as a matter of urgency, an additional 64 staff.
And when you say they're not out there, do you say that they physically, we don't have 64 spare medical scientists in the country?
Correct. We don't. We produce about 90 medical scientists per year from three accredited courses, both that would be TU Dublin, CIT in Cork, and GMIT in Galway. And at this point, I would say there is hardly a graduate from 2020 who is not now in full employment. The 64 people just are not out there. Many labs are operating using agency staff from other countries. A lot of agency staff come from the UK. That's going to be an additional problem when we're going to face when Brexit comes in at the end of the year, where these people will not be able to work in this country unless they register to work in this country. So what they're looking to do is bring in a programme where we take in graduates who have similar qualifications, so in other biological sciences, and hopefully put a programme together where these scientists can be trained, brought into the workforce, trained and educated to become medical scientists on a kind of earn and learn basis, so that we get hands and bodies on the ground straight away, and at the end of a period, these people will be eligible to register with the regulator.
It does seem, though, a bit of a patchwork approach in the middle of a pandemic, given how crucial we know that lab capacity is to us at this moment in time.
It is. I suppose people in laboratories are solutions driven. So this is a solution that has been come to. All the details are not worked out, but it is, we need people, we need them now. We, at the same time, are looking to increase the intake into the colleges. There's also a plan to have a postgraduate entry programme starting in February, but those take time.
Okay.
And we don't have the time now.
Yeah, is that David?
Yeah, just a very quick point. I have the figures from the Beyond Call for Ireland response, and these are of the 70,000 people who responded to that. It was whittled down to about 3,000 who were deemed to be frontline and were candidates that were suitable to be employed. Of that, there was 27 medical scientists. Only 3 were employed. 9 have dropped out since, and 14 still have not been offered contracts. So why have those 14 people not been offered contracts? And the same then, if you look at medical laboratory aides, 64 have not been offered contracts. So at a time when we know we need this additional staff, it is just staggering that we have 14 medical scientists in the pool waiting to be offered a job. 8 of them are deemed to be job ready, and yet they have been in this pool since June of this year and have not been offered contracts.
I think you need to realise, David, that to be employed as a medical scientist, if you have not been working for 2 of the previous 5 years on the day the register for medical scientists open, you have to register with CORU before you can be employed as a medical scientist. I am not aware of who the medical scientists who are on the call for Ireland, who they are or what their qualifications actually are. That process was being run through a recruitment agency, but I do know that the Academy of Clinical Science and Laboratory Medicine had a parallel list of people who were prepared to help, many of whom were scientists who were in retirement, who were coming back in to work to help out in the short term without any intention of providing a service into the future.
And just very quickly, Katie, if I can say that 8 of those are deemed to be job ready, and I would assume that if they are deemed to be job ready, haven't come through clearance, haven't come through the candidate interview process, that they would be qualified to work, but they simply haven't been given the contracts.
Okay. And I just want to ask you, just before we move on, Mari, the Medical Laboratory Sciences Association, that's your professional body, they have voted last weekend to take up industrial action.
Yes, the MLSA is the union representing the medical scientists who work in clinical laboratories, as distinct from the academy, which is the professional body. But we're two sister organisations. And yes, the MLSA voted overwhelmingly to give their executive a mandate to move forward on seeking parity with other scientists in laboratory medicine. Medical scientists do a qualification that takes 4 years, which is specifically designed to have them working in clinical laboratories. They do a clinical laboratory placement. As part of that, they are educated and trained to work in all the laboratories, and they also do a research project that is
laboratory-focused.
But I
appreciate you. Just you feel that there is a parity issue there and a pay issue, obviously. How again, as I asked Dr. Kelly, how concerned should we be about the fact that this mandate is now there for strike action?
I think we should be very concerned. This, way back in 2002, there was an agreement. There were expert groups which said that there should be parity. And the parity was there for a short period until benchmarking, which split it again. The MLSA has been promised since then that there would be, that the parity would be restored in various ways. It has not. And then more recently, another group of colleagues who are the laboratory assistants who report to the medical scientists had a job evaluation. That job evaluation then put them on a salary that is greater than the medical scientist to whom they report.
Okay. Well, I'm sure this will be come back again, Mari, but I'm going to have to take a break there.
Tweet at Saturday RTE.
And you're welcome back. And I want to go now to Duncan Graham, because Duncan, your organisation, Retail Excellence, is writing to the Thánaiste to ask the government to ensure that level 5 COVID regulations for retail outlets are properly enforced. And you've an issue, you're claiming that certain large retailers are abusing the restrictions by continuing to sell non-essential goods as well as essential goods. Are you referring to supermarkets here?
Yeah, look, let's just go back a bit here. We've been asking the government for some time to be making all retail essential at this time of the year. You know, this has been a dreadful week for retail. You know, there was a palpable sense of shock on Monday evening when we moved to level 5. You know, and people are very anxious, they're very worried, they're very upset out there. You know, but we've got a situation where, you know, over the last 4 days, we must have taken hundreds of calls in our office and emails from literally hundreds of people seeking, in the first instance, clarification of what was in the guidelines. That was the first thing. And then secondly, we've seen this movement to a sense of anger among smaller retailers who've been doing the right thing. They've been they've been closing their businesses down. They've been moving online. But then they're seeing that somebody down the road, some of the larger retailers down the road, are still selling the what are classed as these non-essential products. So that's what we're seeing. That's the situation that we have at this moment in time. And really what we're asking for is a level playing field, because at the moment it doesn't feel as though we've got that.
But there couldn't be a level playing field, really, unless everyone was closed down, if you know what I mean. I'm wondering what you're saying the impact on your members is. If they're closed, they can't sell these products anyway. Is it a kind of a dog in a manger scenario?
Well, look, if they're closed down, yes. The one thing that's happening here for the next, you know, we've now got 6 weeks worth of closure of non-essential retail. Now, that effectively means that all of those people are going to be, all of those retailers are going to be going online. So the government have been useful in terms of saying, let's get online open, let's get click and collect open, let's get delivery services open. So that's where we're going to go. But at the end of the day, that's moving us into a space where, as we look at things as stand at the moment, 70% of all of the online traffic in this country goes out. It goes to overseas. So we really need the government to come in behind, encourage people to shop local and keep these local retailers, these non-essential retailers, alive and kicking before over these next 6 weeks.
And you're also concerned that the CRIS scheme to support your members and others in this situation isn't up and running yet, even though your members have had to close their doors.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this CRIS scheme, the COVID Recovery Support Scheme, was set up at the budget. It is literally, we were told by the Thánaiste actually on Wednesday evening that it would be going live very shortly. But, you know, that's 10 days now since the budget. And we're looking at that potentially going live. Well, at this stage, it's going to be Tuesday, Wednesday, isn't it? So,
yeah, we have a very short statement in from Revenue in relation to that. Revenue has been working to put the necessary system changes in place to administer the scheme. Businesses will be able to register via ROSS, that's the Revenue Online System, to make a CRIS claim by the end of next week. Thereafter, an online claim portal in respect of CRIS will be available via the repayment system on ROSS from mid-November, they're saying there. So,
yeah, so mid-November, yeah. You know, we're kicking the can down the road again. You know, this is a time at which retailers are desperate at this moment in time. There are going to be 60,000 retail workers that are likely to be going on to the PUP payment as a result of this move to level 5. That's 60,000. That is in addition to the 30,000 that already have moved on to the PUP since the last lockdown. 100,000 people nearly that are going to be claiming the PUP. We certainly need a lot of these grants through government to be speeded up. I mean, you just got to take the employment wage subsidy scheme, for example. It was taking up to 6 weeks for the payments to be made by Revenue back to employers in that purpose. And, you know, it's just not sustainable in the long run.
Okay, let me put that to the Minister.
Well, can I just comment on two things? Because I want to comment on the first part of that as
quickly.
Well. Absolutely agree with the small business owners, the length and breadth, men and women around this country running businesses. It is totally unacceptable that rich multinational companies, British and German supermarkets, or Irish-owned huge supermarkets would take an opportunity to trade in non-essential goods, which it's not dog in a manger stuff, as you alluded to. It is having a direct impact on small businesses, and they must stop doing that.
In terms of what the government can do in relation to speeding up these grants,
the government has introduced one of the most progressive schemes to support businesses that there is in terms of that payment. It was always announced that it was going to be with immediate effect from when a lockdown condition applied, but that it would take until about the second week of November for payments
so
to come through.
So that's the fastest you're saying that can be done?
It is, absolutely, because the scale of what you're trying to do and the innovative fact that something like this has never been done before means it'll take that time, unfortunately.
Okay. I'm going to move on because we don't have a lot of time left, but I'm really anxious to get to this because this has been a huge issue politically and for people out there this week. And this is this controversial legislation on the records of the Mother and Baby Homes Commission, which passed through all stages this week. It's now emerged that the Data Protection Commission had advised the Department of Children that sealing these records will breach Irish and European law in relation to people's rights to access personal information. I'll just let Breed, you've been active on this campaign for some time.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happened this week was really quite shocking. And for decades, we have seen the state brutalise and mistreat and even malnourish and deny and lie to and kidnap children and torture women. They live with the torture, and their generations after them live with the torture of the memory and the emotion of what they went through. But not to overemphasise that, there's a very, very worrying ethos behind this idea of sealing the files. So, for example, it's not just about the witnesses and their statements. That's absolutely a big part of it. But I asked the minister what else will be sealed. And he said, well, I know there are some records of institutions and departments, but I don't know everything that's going to be sealed. And I repeatedly asked him, you don't know everything that's going into the seal, yet you're prepared to seal it. Could it be possible that there's information in there that the state and that people should have access to beyond the personal information? And he couldn't answer me. And then we had Deputy Catherine Connolly continually asking him why he hadn't published the sixth interim report. And he couldn't answer that and wouldn't answer. He said it was the Attorney General advised him not to. So if this stinks to the whole nation, is because it is stinky. It smells, and it smells of an attempt to bury the truth. And not just about individual records, but about the whole institutionalised and systemic nature of how women and children were treated in these homes over, you're talking 7-8 decades.
Colin Brophy.
Well, the minister has no intention of trying to bury anything or bury the truth.
He doesn't know what he's burying.
To answer the question that you raised, the Data Protection Commissioner did raise the game, but it is important to note that the Minister acknowledged that there were different legal opinions in his contribution to the Dáil.
When you say
on multiple occasions.
But when you see the academics, lawyers, right across the board, I actually have not seen anyone outside of government make the case that government is making in relation to this or the department is making. The general view is that the government's take on this is wrong-headed.
Well, I don't accept that. In actual fact, the minister must, as any minister must, take the legal advice supplied by the Attorney General. And I don't think it's right to question the bona fides of the AG's advice. I think the AG's advice is put to the government. The minister takes that advice. And if the AG believes that there is a course of action which must be followed, then the minister must follow that course of action. That's the point of having an Attorney General.
I thought the point of having a minister is that they took advice and then made decisions on it.
You follow as a minister the advice from the Attorney General in relegation to the legality.
You're not legally obliged to do that. You have a certain independence because after all, you're elected and he isn't. But you
have an Attorney General who is there to advise the government.
The advice is given
to the minister, and the minister is following that advice.
So he chooses to take the advice of the Attorney General and ignore the advice of the Data Protection Commissioner and ignore the expressed will of the thousands of survivors who do not want this to happen.
Well, it is important.
Like, it just is incredible. But he also did it with such haste, such indecent haste, that it made it look like he is hiding something.
Moving aside from the disputes and the confusion around the import of this legislation and where we're going with it. Why did he not stand back and say, look, given the amount of distress out there with this very vulnerable and already distressed cohort of people, why not hold on, cool the jets, and have you know, put the effort into communicating what he says is the reasonable course of action.
Well, I mean, and it is important. Thank you for acknowledging that the minister has gone out of his way to make the point that he would like that consultation to have been more, that he would like to have had the ability to engage more in it. There was a legal constraint in relation to the timeline of the report coming in,
which he could have changed,
and what would have happened, and the advice which he was given in relation to how that would affect the ceiling meant that he felt it was appropriate to proceed with the legislation.
Okay, well,
and that is why he did it in the way he did.
He didn't
but
have to do it with the haste also, he did it.
He's also acknowledged that he would like to have had the time to have more consultation, and he thinks there are very valid points being raised which he wants to engage on.
Okay, I know that David wants to get in, but unfortunately we're over time, and I have been given a statement from the Department of Education, which I do have to get in. I'm told this is in relation to the hand sanitizer issue we spoke about at the top of the programme. It says the Department of Education was formally notified in the afternoon of Thursday, the 22nd of October, that's last Thursday, that the Department of Agriculture had removed ViraPro hand sanitizer from the product register. There was an immediate follow-up with the Department of Education, and contact was made with DAFM in order to secure more details, and that work continued all afternoon and into the late evening to establish the facts in relation to the product concerned, the reasons for the product recall, the lab testing results, and the understanding of public health concerns. The Minister for Education was informed that evening. Prior to this, the Department of Agriculture had contacted the Education Procurement Service by phone on the afternoon of Tuesday, the 20th of October. So there we have it. There was a phone contact made on the Tuesday, but they say the formal contact was not made until the Thursday. And that's all we have time for. Enjoy the rest of your bank holiday weekend out there. I want to thank my panel. Thank you all for listening. And as I say, enjoy the weekend.
Saturday with Katie Hannan. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.
And Saturday with Katie Hannan was produced by Mary O'Hagan. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon. Research was by Andrew Fleming, and sound was by Tom Norton.